Thank you for downloading this episode of Software Gone Wild, a podcast focused on everything software-defined. To get more episodes and explore other SDN and network automation resources, visit sdn.ipspace.net.
You know that on Software Gone Wild, we tend to focus on real-life stuff that you can use in your network. Today, we'll deviate a little bit, and we'll talk about something that one of my friends would call unicorn driving a flying DeLorean with a flux capacitor. It all started with one of my rants about SDN and the throw of disillusionment. And I got an email back saying, well, let's talk about a more dramatic view, the self-driving network, one whose operation is totally automated. Usually I would go like, yeah, sure. But this email came from Kiriti Kompela, whom some of you might remember as the guy that was doing the development of MPLS PseudoWires. And in those days, we were talking about the Kompela draft and some other draft that I can't remember what it was. Anyway. With us today is Kiriti Kompela, CTO at Juniper Networks. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
What were you doing between the time that you were working on the MPLS stuff and today that you're talking about the self-driving networks? How did you make this transition?
The transition was very sudden, but in between, what I was working on was the idea of how can I make the networks do more on their own. Back in the day, I was doing plug-and-play MPLS because everyone said MPLS is too complicated, too difficult to provision, too difficult to manage. And I'm looking at Ethernet, and you just plug things in and they work, except it's a poor technology from many points of view. So I tried to do plug-and-play MPLS. Then I started working on something called resilient MPLS rings, which is a takeoff on resilient packet rings. But there, again, the goal was starting with resiliency, but moving on to can the ring self-configure. But the transition was fast because what happened is I live in a neighborhood where I see all these Google cars, Waymo cars, whatever you want to call them today. And I said, if those guys can actually drive the car on their own, you know, robotically, why are we sitting so far behind in networking? And we're talking about, you know, I love automation. I love all these things that we talk about. And thank you, Ivan, for emphasizing the need for automation and doing this evaluation of different vendors from an automation point of view. But that is from outside. There's still a human behind it. The question is, can you have closed loop automation? These cars are doing it. Why can't we do it in network? So that was sort of the genesis. Going from plug-and-play MPLS to resilient MPLS rings that self-configure to let's just do the whole network.
And before we go into details, let me introduce the other two co-hosts that will ask all the questions that I always forget asking. Nick Buraglio with a service provider perspective and Chris Young with the network management perspective. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So, Kiriti, the idea sounds great. Why do you think we are not there yet?
In many ways, we are taking small steps here. Like I said, there's a certain amount of automation in the network. I think there could be more, but there are some first steps. People talk about self-organizing networks in the mobile space, but primarily it's about how do I control my radio? How do I make the radio self-adaptive? People talk about zero-touch provisioning. That's one aspect. It's the provisioning aspect. But I think if you look at the Waymo car, there is no steering wheel. There are no pedals. It's not, you know, I will take the transmission and make that automatic, or I will give you cruise control. It's, I'm taking everything out. I'll give you a screen that says, tell me where you want to go, and I'll take you there. So we're far from that in networking.
Yeah, but as you pointed in your presentation, which I will include in the show notes, the car industry really started in 1895 or so.
Sure.
So it took them 120 years to get where they are today. And real networking has only been around for maybe 40 years. So we still have another 8 years to go.
Sure. And meanwhile, the economics is not working and people are saying, maybe we should get out of networking or do something else. So no, my daughters won't let that happen. They need the network.
There's a lot of parallels too, right? I mean, your car analogy sort of, you know, made me think a little bit. Like, what are the reasons that, you know, say, for example, service provider world, right? That's where I spend most of my time. What are the reasons why some of this automation hasn't happened yet? I mean, you can talk about the large, you know, extremely big footprint backbone networks, you know, the AT&Ts, the, you know, the CenturyLinks, and the big guys, right? They have the resources to sort of invest in the development that's required for doing some sort of automation, right? Not necessarily self-driving. But, you know, those guys are, they may be large in footprint and, you know, gigantic in scale, but they are by no means the majority, right? There are mom and pop service providers everywhere, you know, all over the globe that don't have the resources to do any of those things. So I think that the reason a lot of that's taking a long time is that not everybody's Google, right? Not everybody prints money and can just say, well, this didn't, you know, this multi-million dollar fiber expansion we did didn't work. So I'm just going to shut it off. It's very similar to the cars, right? Everybody has a car. I personally will drive my car until it falls apart because I don't want to spend money on a new one. And I think a lot of people have the same, you know, they have the same mindset where if this is not, I already have a mechanism for doing this thing and I don't need to change it because it currently works. So I'm just going to wait. That's just one thing, right? I'm not saying that that's right or wrong. I think, but that's a reason that some of these things take a long time, like, you know, adding automatic transmissions to a car.
I think the other thing, you know, specific to networking and that analogy of cars that really is going to drive this further out is the fact that we agree more or less, at least in North America, we agree what the rules of the road are. We know that you should pass on the left. We know that a stop sign means stop. You know, we know that you drive on the right side of the road. I don't think that we have a common vision of what a network is supposed to look like or even what protocols are supposed to be used or any of those defined rules. Like those, that doesn't exist yet. So how do we get past that point? Like this, it comes back to the artisanal handcrafted heritage designs that we all love to do as networking engineers.
Which is what the majority of networks are, realistically.
Yeah, everyone is building his own car because it's fun.
Right. Yes.
And what would happen if you took one of those Google cars and you put that on the road in the UK?
You probably have some problems.
Like,
right. I mean, we've got, right? What we have is not necessarily a firm set of primitives that we can work from. We've got, you know, just like in the movie Ghostbusters, right? It's more of a guideline than a rule, right? I can build a network across the nation and use only static routes and all SONET interfaces. But that's probably not the best way to do it. Somebody probably has done that already. It's a much deeper layer. Like you have to have connectivity from this to this in order to move these. So we have roads and that's pretty much the extent of it. Like how those roads are paved, not really a rule, right? More of a guideline.
Right. And that's anathema to the, you know, what they call FANG, Facebook, Amazon, Google. I forget who the N is. These, when they build data centers, they want to take this cookie cutter thing. This is the server I'm going to use. This is the storage I'm going to use. Now I'm going to replicate that 100,000 times. When we build networks, as someone said, we're building artisanal networks. And that does not scale. And fundamentally, networks have become completely necessary for day-to-day living, completely necessary for everything we do. And yet, you know, the constant theme is, I can't afford this. And usually, as a vendor, what I hear is, I need the CapEx to be lowered. The cost of the equipment has to come down. It actually does. Year on year, the cost of bandwidth comes down by a significant fraction. The cost of interfaces, the cost of the optics. But operational expense keeps going up. I think that's the problem we have to attack. How do I make this easier to manage? How do I make it more accurate? How do I make it proactive instead of reactive? These are the things that we're not necessarily thinking enough about, but others are doing it. They're increasing the automation, their data centers, the increasing automation in every aspect, even cars. So how do we bring that to networking?
I think that's a pretty good point in that you're saying that the operational expense is not going down. It's probably going up because as the networks get more complicated, they become more difficult to run unless you're able to afford making, you know, investing in someone or a, you know, in some automation in some way, right? So that you can remove humans from that particular, you know, it's sort of like the, you know, the automation of manufacturing, right? Very similar, right? Everything used to be handcrafted and put together. Now machines do it. How do we apply that to complicated networking?
Well, there are two things at play here that we keep forgetting. One is that people like Facebook, Amazon, and Google make their networks as simple as possible. And whenever an application owner comes along saying, I want to have this because whatever, they'll tell him no.
Yeah. Yes.
If you want to deploy your application in the Amazon cloud and you need IP multicast, you can just turn around and walk away. You will not get it. It took them 10 years to get IPv6 up and running. They were in no hurry.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's one thing. Yeah, they are experiencing problems because of the scale they have, but their networks are as simple as they can be. They are as homogeneous as they can be. And so it's easier to make them self-driving.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, they're data centers too. And a data center is a controlled environment by nature. That makes, you know, replicating things in a way that is, you know, easy to understand, very simple, a lot less painful to accomplish. When you start venturing out into, you know, into the wild where you've got, you know, a shack on the side of railroad tracks in the middle of nowhere that you have to put an amp in or something, you know, that's a very different type of environment. You may have IRUs on dark fiber and you may have, you know, a lit service in another location. So, I mean, there's a lot of things, there's a lot of extra baggage that comes along with stuff that's not inside a nice, fuzzy data center, you know, that's covered in gumdrop houses and lollipop trees outside. I mean, a data center is easy, comparatively speaking. I would argue I've done both.
Well, Google talks about the I-scale network and the G-scale network. So not just in the data center, but the network that connects their data centers together is much more under control if they want to do a big backup or a synchronization. And for some reason, they have to stop it or it fails. They'll just restart it. That's under control. The I-scale network, the internet scale network, where customers come in, do the search, you know, click on ads and stuff, that's much more unpredictable. And that's the network they really care about. So they do have this dichotomy of networking. But I want to go back to the point where it's not just that the networks are simpler in the data center or the networks that are more controlled, but the fact that your wide area network could go anywhere, it might have to go into regions where there's very low population density. You're going over regions where fiber has to travel a really long distance. And as you said, you put this amp in a shed somewhere. It follows the geography that you need to cover, very unlike data center. But the other problem is the people that you're looking for are, you know, GNCIEs or CCIEs. They're experts in BGP. They're experts in OSPF or ISIS. They know how to tweak these policies. Where do you find them today? People are not graduating from school and from college saying, I want to be a network engineer, not as much as they used to. They want to go off and do other things.
I don't know anybody ever came out of college and said, I want to be a network engineer.
Yeah, I didn't either. Me either.
I did, but I'm old.
I went old to art school.
I was a poli-sci major.
Maybe we should be talking to you more. You know, layer 9 is where all the action is.
True, true.
Yeah, I still chose to get away from it. Tells you what it's like up there.
But networks are important. And just today we were having a meeting where someone said, it's so much easier for someone who's doing cut and paste of configs from one router to another router to continue doing that. You know, someone who knows programming would do that 5 times, 10 times and say, I'm done with this. Even if the cut and paste takes me 10 seconds to do, I'm so done with this. I'm going to go off and write a Python script to do this. And if that script takes me an hour, it takes me, you know, 3 days to debug it and get it right, I'll do it. But then after that, no more cut and paste for me. We don't fundamentally have that attitude in networking. This way works, I'll just continue doing it. And that's not how you make progress.
I think we're getting there, though. I think that what I've seen in the last three years is where I've seen that really start to change. But some of the early adopters, the Jason Edelmans of the world, that kind of jumped out of networking and said, I have this vision. We're starting to see that. So I think.
Yes.
Yeah. I think most of those guys came from, or at least had a relatively significant amount of development training or knew how to write code. And I think that's sort of making your point, right? Is that this came from the development side. Because I had a guy that worked with me at one point and he said, if I have to do any, and he was a networking engineer, so if I have to do anything more than 3 times, I'm writing a script, right? But he had a really strong development background as his formal, you know, collegiate training.
Yep.
And you have to have a certain mindset. You have to get bored of doing the same thing 3 times. A lot of people find, I don't know, comfort in that or job security or something. So you really have to want to find a better way.
Yeah, but you have to ask, is he really doing the same thing 3 times? And there's the problem. I was preaching network automation to whoever is willing to listen. And a lot of service providers come back saying, well, we love the idea, but you know what? Our sales team would sell anything to the customer just to get the order. And then we have to implement that so every customer is unique. So it might look like that guy is doing the same thing 300 times. But are we sure that he's not doing something different every time just because the sales guy sold it?
This is a common problem in service provider networks, right? Everything is a snowflake.
It's worse in enterprise, trust me.
Well, I haven't been in that world a long time, so I'll take the word for it.
I live in that world. It's a scary place.
But Ivan, let's go back to what you were saying about Amazon. Just say no. And if you're willing to craft something different for every customer, I mean, there are times you have to. But if you're willing to say, either say no or tweak it so that you can get to a place where it's not the same thing, but it's at least parameterizable. And then you put a few things there and say, okay, there are going to be these 5 broad classes or maybe even 25 broad classes. But within those, every customer that comes in, I'm going to push them to one of those. Then you have a hope.
That's exactly what I'm telling them. And by the way, people like NTT got the message probably 10 years ago. I know that they have totally automated the orchestration of their network. I don't know how many years back. There's a NANOC presentation for anyone who's interested in that one. But they're one of the few that got to the point where they specified what the services are and you can only get that and nothing else.
Yeah, NTT had some real sharp people, you know, that were sort of driving a lot of those things. And I think that they're a good example of how you can take, you know, the handcrafted artisanal networking and say, okay, well, we have to whittle this down into some buckets. And there might be 25 buckets to start with, but they're at least buckets, right? And then as time goes on, you just start throwing buckets away. Because a lot of times, and at least in my experience, is that I would say 70% of the time that those sort of off the wall, odd requests that come in, they don't even get utilized. They're requests because they think they might need them.
And once you put them in the network, you never get them out.
Yes.
Exactly. Oh, IPv4 multicast is a perfect example of that. The right answer to V4 multicast is always no, especially if it's interdomain.
I want to make one point about Amazon, which I think is a critical point for all of this versus service providers, is Amazon's main business wasn't networking. So they really didn't care about the revenue stream because that wasn't their primary revenue stream. And that allowed them to say no repeatedly because by saying no, they retained the resiliency and the stability of their core network, which was what delivered their actual business, which was selling products. And it's only after that 10 years and they were able to say no repeatedly that the rest of us kind of got the message. So I think that's key. key difference between the service provider market, where the sales guys will sell anything to anybody who will give them money.
I wanted to bring in this technology called ATM, automatic teller machines.
Oh, the other ATM.
I was like,
other
what?
ATM. Yeah, exactly. There, you're basically saying you want the bank to stay open on weekends. You want the bank to stay open later. I could do that, but I'm just going to make you do it on your own. And of course, you go from ATM to online banking, assuming that you get the security part right. You're basically telling the customer, you want to customize it, you go ahead. And if you, so the alternative of saying no is, I'll give you the basic stuff. I'll give you these bells and whistles that you can build yourself, and I'll bill you for them, but I won't build them for you.
That's essentially self-service, right? That's self-service yes. banking. And so what we're thinking about, you know, from the networking perspective, you know, and I think we just did a podcast that was essentially a self-service networking, carrier networking, right, Yvonne? I mean, the packet fabric stuff is functionally similar to what you've just described, where you go, you know, you have a presence at this location. So you've gone to the ATM, you know where it is, you put your card in, you know, you give packet fabric your payment information and you say, connect me from here to here. And you click a button and it happens. It's like putting your PIN in and getting cash out.
Yeah, but Nick, what they're doing is a very simple service. It's point-to-point Ethernet line.
Right. I mean, I think that's how you have to start, right? You can't start by saying, I'm gonna get an airplane that has no pilot and hope it gets me where I need to go, right? The autopilot does that, but there's actually a person there just in case.
If you put automation in your network, if your infrastructure was, you know, more or less self-provisioning, then when you layer on top of that self-service, when you say, here's portal, the portal can get more and more complex, because what you don't want is from the portal a fax going out to a human saying, this is what the person just ordered, because that's no better. You want that portal, the back end of it, to directly go and do what needs to be done in the network, which means you've automated all of that. And then you can say it's more than just a point-to-point Ethernet. It's, you know, ACL of some kind if you want it. It's QoS policies. It's connectivity among 20 sites, whatever you need.
Right. No, I agree. I think what I'm trying to say is that you have to start with building the roads, right?
Yes.
The point-to-point yes. Ethernet service is a known paved road that goes from point A to point B, where you get to decide where those two points are, right? So right there, you've got your foundation, your primitive to start with. And on top of that, you can build, well, I want to go from here to here, but I only want this prefix to be able to talk over this road. I only want these kind of cars to drive on it.
Right.
And then you just get more and more complicated as you go on. But I think that the point I'm trying to make in a very rambling way is that you have to start with that foundational piece, and that exists now. Like, even though like 10 minutes ago I said it didn't, there are some people that are out there trying to build that foundational piece.
Right. And this comes to another thing that's really important, because you're a networking geek, I'm a networking geek, we're all networking geeks here. But the person who's using this portal may not be. And so when you just said prefix, I know what you're talking about, but they probably don't. And they want to talk in terms of what applications are doing. They want to talk in terms of security at a higher level than we would normally. So if you said ACL, they'd probably run away. But they want to say, protect me from these guys, or, you know, only let these things talk. And so we also have to go up the stack in terms of how we describe what you want to have happen in the network. What now everyone calls intent-oriented networking, I like to call declarative statement of intent. Don't tell me how to do it. Tell me what you want. And then you need the translation from this statement of what you want to how to do it on this box, on this OS, on this version of code. But that's the detail that your backend, the automation, should take care of. And as a customer, you know, sitting at the self-service portal, I shouldn't have to deal with that level.
Yeah, but what we keep forgetting is that we are really in the infrastructure business. So none of us really wants to know how the roads are built, right? We just want to drive.
Yep.
But the guys who build the cars have to know what the physical characteristics of the roads are. They can't ignore the laws of physics.
Yeah.
And in IT, the guys building the cars are really the application developers. And we tell them all the time that they can ignore the laws of physics because the unicorn driving the flying DeLorean will take care of that.
And it will. So let me bring in another technology, machine learning. And by the way, I want to be very clear. I'm not doing this for technology's purpose, for technology's sake. I'd really like to aim for much more automation in the network to the extent that the network will run itself. So we've had multiple goes at exactly what you're talking about, Ivan. Should the application tell the network what it wants? Should the network treat applications more, differently because somebody configured that this application should run in this way and that application should run in a different way? Both of those were proposed, both those approaches, and neither of them really stuck. One of them put all the burden on the operator to configure things right and recognize these 10 classes of applications. And the other puts the burden on the application writer to understand more and more of networking. So here's a third approach. You write your application the way you want. You run it. I, as the operator, I'm just going to say, this is an application I care about. I want to make sure it runs well. And I have machine learning in the network saying, let me start understanding how this application uses the network, who it talks to, how much bandwidth it sends, and what are its patterns. And let me adapt the network to that. So I need data. I need to let the application run for a while. Maybe I can find some similar applications. But once I have that, the network will adapt to this. I, as an operator, I don't have to configure it. You, as the application developer, don't have to think about networking when you're writing your app. The network will learn and adapt. So, science fiction, but why not?
I love that vision, but where is that data coming from? We still live in a world where SNMP is king. And like I've seen streaming telemetry. When you dig into it, the streaming telemetry is actually based on a 300-second polling period. That sounds familiar. So you've just changed the compartmentalization of an SNMP protocol into a REST push JSON, Google protobufs, whatever. It doesn't matter. And you're still, I had a friend of mine, awesome quote, an SNMP trap is like a fireball that lets you know the plane just crashed. Like on a 300-second scale, that doesn't do me any good. So that telemetry, there are some vendors out there that are looking at some interesting things. And then the other thing is, from a hardware perspective, we have all these little anemic CPUs that, look what happens when you pull it through SNMP multiple times, they fall over and die. So, right. My big, I love the vision, don't get me wrong. I absolutely 100% agree that machine learning, when applied properly, is going to get us to where we eventually want to be, but we don't have roads yet.
So we actually have streaming telemetry. You can do it at 1 second intervals. You can do it at sub-second intervals. When people talk about queue depths, you want to get to sub-millisecond intervals. We're close. We have streaming telemetry coming from the ASIC. This is not sent by the ASIC to a CPU, an anemic or otherwise, get reprocessed there and then sent out. It's coming straight out of the ASIC. Not in every case, but in many cases. So there is some good streaming telemetry out there.
So let me give my rebuttal to that. You're right. You had to mention the dirty word of SNMP, which I have an extreme disdain for the exact same reasons. However, I'm going to self-plug here for just a second. There's a project I've been working on for about a year that is essentially a wide area network correlation tool. And what it does is it takes every data source. It's mostly security focused, but there's no reason it couldn't eventually lend itself to self-driving networks, right? So you've got this correlation tool. It doesn't matter what it is. I've done it with Splunk. I've done it with Elk that you can scale out based on how much data you send into it. When that data gets into it, there's logic that does essentially pattern matching and baseline deviation detection. And then from there, it can do things like perform actions. The simplest actions that we implemented in the prototype were, insert a BGP null route or insert a flow mod that is a drop. And so the trick is to think about all of the other data sources that aren't necessarily always considered when you're thinking about network data. So an SNMP trap is great, but you're right. It's a fireball that lets you know the plane crashed 5 minutes ago. Yes. And that, you know, that sucks, for lack of any better description. But you've got other things that might be indicators of problems, like syslogs. You've got things that might be other indicators of other issues, like a ramping up DDoS attack. Like, suddenly I see a whole bunch of UDP 123 traffic. Where's that coming from, right? Go and look at the network topology and figure that out. And then you can filter it. So there are other ways to find that data. You just have to be creative and you have to correlate them together. You're not going to get one thing, I don't think. Streaming telemetry sounds great, but my guess is for the foreseeable future, it's going to be essentially a little bit faster version of SNMP that you get thrown at you via a fire hose instead of going and asking for
it. And I think this is, as Kidity pointed out, there is a vendor-specific implementations of what that means. And they really vary greatly between, you know, what's actually in the box. When you open up that box marked streaming telemetry, you might want to look at the docs first and figure out what's really in there, because you might only be getting basically if octets in, octets out every 300 seconds versus almost, you know, to Juniper, I guess. I'm assuming it would be Juniper, making an assumption here, that's getting almost to queue depth, buffer depths. Like, and that's really, really cool. And I think the other thing that I would say is the other question is when we start looking at what's going across the network, I've also got a huge concern about technologies like S-Flow and NetFlow. When everything is going over port 443 or HTTPS and it's all HTTP 2.0 and it's all encrypted and everything's a web app, how do we differentiate anything? There's all these different questions.
In that case, you have to look at source dest. That's a fundamental difference between an enterprise mindset and a service provider mindset. I don't want to see what's in the packets because that's extra computational power I don't have. But from an enterprise, you want to see everything. You want to make sure there's no exfiltration of sensitive data happening.
Even if you're a service provider, you still want to maybe protect your own infrastructure and maybe protect some of your customers who've paid extra for that. The way you do that, though, is by looking at the source desk and saying, these are the patterns of behavior from this customer, from this subscriber. And then when it deviates, either in volume or in direction or whatever, you say, hey, maybe I should throw that through a DPI and see what's going on. Or maybe that's some traffic that I want to get into if you have the keys. There's, of course, this whole movement to encrypting right from the browser. So you won't even be able to do that. But at least you can flag some things but you have to build up the baseline. This is who this app talks to, and this is the kind of traffic patterns they use. Why is it different? What changed?
Okay. Now, if I may step back a little bit, we've been all over the place, but we still haven't got to the first step in self-driving networks. So with self-driving cars, there are these 6 levels of autonomy from 0 to 5. And let's agree that level 0 is boring. So level 1, which is some adaptive cruise control and so on, would be maybe the starting point for the networks. What would that be in the networks, and how far away are we from that?
I think a very big part of this, I mean, again, I think everything starts with telemetry and more than just that, correlation. So I get telemetry from layer 0, layer 1, layers, you know, all the way up to layer 7. I get telemetry across different geographies and across timescales. And then I start putting them together and getting more insight into what's going on. Step 2 would be visualization. What is happening in my network? Who's talking to whom? Where are the hotspots, and how does that change, you know, from day to day, from hour to hour, season to season? Beyond that, I think you have to get to the part where I can use all of this to predict what's the network going to look like. Where do I have to maybe do some proactive maintenance? People are suggesting if I look at power levels of lasers, there might be a signature that says it's going to die in a few days. Or maybe a few hours. We don't gather enough of this data, and we don't try to start making sense of it. But if we did, I think we would find that there's a lot of things we could do. And so the next step would be this predictive analytics about what's going to happen. or what is likely to happen. The level beyond that is what I call augmentation, where using whatever technique, machine learning, rule-based systems, or a combination, I take all this massive data that's coming in and I say, hey, if I were you, I would reboot that router or upgrade this device, or I would add more bandwidth to that link. And then the last one, of course, your level five driving is get out of the way. I'm in charge. That's the AI speaking.
I would just love to apply sentiment analysis to my network to understand how it's feeling. Is it bored? Is it grumpy? You know, it's Microsoft Patch Tuesday. It's grumpy.
A lot of the things that you just mentioned, I think, are starting to bubble up. Like, I think there's some optical gear out there, some carrier transport gear that I believe, and I don't remember who makes it, but I believe it has the ability to say, we predict that this optic is going to fail, and then tell you based on, you know, a syslog or however it does it, you know, we think that this transponder is in a pre-failure state. Go, please replace it. So some of that logic is actually starting to surface. But again, there's only a handful of things that are defining what the road is that we need to drive on right now. And I think that's part of the reason that it's taking so long for these things to happen.
Let me take you to a different example. You all know what vMotion is. So let me back up a bit and say, look, I go to Amazon and say, I want to create a virtual machine. And they say, okay, what size do you want? Do you want 3 vCPUs, 4 vCPUs? Do you want so much memory, or, you know, how much storage do you want? And then they won't tell you where it goes, but they'll place your VM somewhere. But then they are constantly monitoring, at least in theory, they're constantly monitoring the CPU and saying, wow, this VM is not doing too well here. Either I'm going to pick this VM up and move it to a different VM, to a different CPU, or I'm going to take other VMs away from here so that everyone is happy. We don't do anything like that in service provider networks. So here I am, I'm a broadband subscriber. I'm physically connected to this DSLAM. Not too much you can do there. But that DSLAM may be connected to a switch network that allows it to go to 3 BNGs.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying, but do keep in mind that Amazon is not moving your VM.
I know.
Neither is Google. Neither is Rackspace, neither is any of the cloud providers that are offering the cheap services that people are looking for. You can't have both.
Okay, sure. So let me back up and say this with the VMware, which is the people who did VMs, vMotion. What they say is, you tell me the characteristics of the VM that you have. I will place it. And this is what vCenter is supposed to do. I'll place it on an appropriate CPU. And then if I, for whatever reason, decide that this VM needs to move, I'm going to use this great technology I have called vMotion and pick it up from this CPU and put it on a different CPU. And the reason for that might be to save power. The reason to do that might be because VM is not behaving well. Or the reason to do that might be I want to take this server down for maintenance. But that's the theory of vMotion. And it depends on streaming telemetry coming out of that server.
Yeah, but my point was that if you want to have, let's say, cheap services, and for whatever stupid reason, no one is willing to pay for expensive services these days. Everyone is complaining how the whole IT is too expensive. If you want to have cheap services, you can't have complex infrastructure. That's why you don't have all these extra features at Amazon's of the world.
Sure.
So it's the same thing with the network. Do we want to keep the network simple and cheap? Or do we want to cram all the complexity into the network and then we will need machine learning to learn how this complex network works?
But if you invest in that infrastructure, and if networking is your primary business, once you do it, then it will run itself. The thing that we don't have today is, if I decide this subscriber or this enterprise is not getting the service that they should be getting, it's a trouble ticket and a whole change operation to pick up the circuit from one, let's call it a network server, except of course it's a PE device or a BNG, and move it to a different one. And all along, I'm scared that I'm going to do it wrong or misconfigure something, or, you know, have extended downtime for this customer. If I automate that, and if either, you know, a human operator pushes the button, or like you said, machine learning will do all this and say, switch over from device one to device two, it doesn't cost anymore. I have to put the infrastructure in place. But once I have that, it doesn't cost anymore, but my customers are happier and maybe I get less churn. I don't think any of this is science fiction. It's, do you want to offer a better service? Are you willing to invest in the infrastructure? And by the way, I want to say one thing about complexity. The anti-lock brakes that are on a car, and I keep going back to the car analogy, but they're really, really, really complex. And if the average person thinks about it for too long, they'll probably start riding a bike again. You have all this measurement of speed, you know, the left wheel and the right wheel are going at different speeds, the relative speed of the car and the wheels on the road. You have to basically do a bunch of math and decide, is it safe to stop the car, or should I just slow down, or should I go with the flow and maybe brake later? All of those computations, all of those calculations have to be done. But people trust their lives to this. So complexity is not the problem. Complexity that's reflected back to the human is the problem. If the anti-lock brake said, oh, by the way, there are these 17 switches like you're in a jet airplane and you have to manage all those, nobody would do it. The UI has not changed. You press on the brake. In fact, you don't even have to pump the brake. Just slam it as hard as you want. I'll take care of the rest. So complexity, you know, I don't think it's a problem if it's serving a purpose and it's not reflected back to the human.
So I'm only playing devil's advocate, because I actually agree with you that some of these things can and are going to happen. But I think that it's important to call out, regardless of where the complexity is, it's always going to be somewhere, right? You can't abstract away all the complexity. It always has to exist in one form or another. It's like matter. It just changes form. But, or energy, I guess. Whatever. You get my point.
Interchangeable.
Yes. Yeah. I'm speaking a little bit above my intelligence level, as usual. But, you know, so I think that complexity has to be understood by someone, or else we end up in the world of Idiocracy, where some smart guy built the time machine, but no one knows how to fix it.
Nick, I can tell you that no one knows how to fix your car.
That's fine. I'm tired of driving it anyway. I'd rather ride my bicycle, to be honest.
Now, if we had a time machine, we'd go back to where people did know how to fix that car.
Yeah. I mean, I guess
not if it was broken.
My point is that I do think that a lot of this stuff can happen, but the complexity isn't going to totally go away. It's just going to move somewhere else. The complexity will move down into the code that does the automation, right? So developers will have to understand that code, and they'll also have to understand, and I've been saying this for, you know, as everybody's been yammering on about the, you know, network engineering is dead, long live the software developer. Someone's going to have to understand the protocols, regardless of if they're writing code around them or if they're trying to fix them when they're broken, right? That complexity is only going to move.
I think that complexity is going to cross a boundary where machine learning starts to produce algorithms that we don't understand, but they just work. And we're already seeing that in a whole bunch of the other machine learning and specialized AI fields. It's happening.
And I don't disagree with that. But again, that complexity is now just moving into the algorithms. And
yeah,
I find it troubling that we may not understand them.
Well, machine learning is undebuggable, as far as I can tell. And I've talked to a few people about this. Great. And when it doesn't work right, you have a few parameters you can tweak, but nobody can debug this. So the complexity is going somewhere. And that's an issue, because, you know, you want somebody to be able to understand this. But at some level, I stick with what I said, which is, if the complexity goes away from the human, it's not presented, at least to the average human. There might be a small class of people that know this.
To the consumer.
Exactly. So, for example, Uber is looking at self-driving cars. And what they're saying is, instead of having this whole big fleet of drivers who may be contractors or employees, or, you know, there's a big battle going on how to classify them. You go from that to a much smaller cadre of programmers who are going to create the AI that will run the cars. And a very small subset of those will probably really understand how all this works. And the rest just know how to manage these things and maybe tweak the AI at a higher level. And that's where you'll end up. Everyone else will have these rides that work really well. And a very small number of people really have to try to deal with that complexity. But as the average consumer, I don't have to. Just the same way that I don't have to deal with the complexity of the anti-lock brake system.
Just thinking that through, I think there's an analogy to where networking is right now, where the majority of people I know that are, and I use the term very loosely, networking engineers, don't actually understand how it works. They just know that they type in OSPF process 1, net area 0, network, and then magic happens.
Right. They understand how to implement the protocols, but they don't understand the underlying data structures that comprise the protocols. And exactly. There's very few people that do.
Oh, they don't even understand why they're using the protocols, let's be honest.
That's in some cases, I think that's true, right?
Because it's magic. It works.
Right? Because you should be running ISIS, not OSPF, right? If they knew better, that's what they do.
That was coming. I could see it.
Okay. We're not going there.
Had to be said.
We're slowly running out of time, so let's try to wrap this up or at least structure it a little bit. What's the first thing I can do to get on this journey?
I think the absolute first thing you have to do is get information about the network and do it in a way that's, you know, the data is reliable, the data is clean. Basically, you have to practice data hygiene and you have to put the data in a place where you can actually correlate across them. So if I get S-flow data, it's not some 4-byte source and a 4-byte destination, but the 4-byte source maps to a subscriber, a 4-byte destination maps to an exit point in my network and a peer that it's going to. And now I have some insight in my network. So I think absolutely the first thing is you want to have a big data problem. So you want to collect lots of data that's useful that you can do something with.
So to summarize, know thy network.
Exactly. Yes. And then to jump to the end, I think you also want to say, what do I want to do with this? You know, there's this grand vision and that's my job is to, you know, throw this big thing up there. But what does self-driving mean for you? What is the first step in self-driving that you want to do? And in fact, since I'm redefining SDN, I could also redefine it to self-defending. And so do I want to use this data to establish baselines so I can find anomalies and know when to look deeper into some flow or look deeper into some application and say, why is my network behaving like this? So it's really important to ask the question, what do I want to do? What do I want to, you know, run itself? Do I want the self-defending aspect? Do I want to optimize my network, optimize my resources? Do I want to give better service to my customers? What's my priority? And, you know, you're not going to get from nothing where we are to completely self-driving network, you have to take a path there. And so I want to go back to this DARPA Grand Challenge back in 2004, saying, drive this section of the freeway. This was I-15 in the Mojave Desert. There's going to be no other human cars. There'll just be these robotic cars. Get from this point A to this point B and just show me you can do that. And they failed, by the way. They tried again in 2005. And then in 2007, they said, okay, let's do this in an urban environment with humans and with traffic lights and everything. So you take these steps, but you have to decide what is the step I want to take. And then you say, okay, how do I get from where I am? How do I use all this data that I'm collecting and correlating? And how do I get to this endpoint, which is a self-defending network or a self-driving optimized core network?
So let's wrap it up right here. Thanks a million, Kirti, for this discussion. If people want to know more about these ideas, where can they find you? Where can they find your presentations? How can they get in touch?
If you go to www.juniper.net, please remember the net, there's a section, a landing page for self-driving networks. And in that, we're putting material, and every so often we put some more material, some videos that I've done, some white papers, and that's a really good source. You can find me at kirti@juniper.net, K-I-R-E-E-T-I, and usually responsive.
So just go to juniper.net and search for self-driving networks.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Yes, thank you.
Nick, Chris, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter, @Braulio. And then I have a website, forwardingplane.net, that I blog at occasionally.
And I'm Netman Chris on Twitter, and controlissuesw.net is the blog that I need to get back to at some point in the near future.
And I'm Ivan Pepelniak, and you've been listening to a futuristic version of Software Gone Wild. If you want to hear more podcasts, just go to podcast.ibspace.net and start exploring. For anything else, why don't you start at sdn.ibspace.net.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Software Gone Wild. If you want to learn more about software-defined networking, network automation, and related topics, visit sdn.ipspace.net and explore our courses, books, webinars, and podcasts.
I tell everyone Ivan Pepelniak.
Perfect.
And they don't know who I'm talking about. And then I say, Ivan Pepelniak. And they, oh, yeah, we know him. We know him.
Those Americans.
Yeah, I know.
My grandmother says our name wrong, and it's been her name for like 50 years. So
it's Braulio, right?
Braulio is correct. But I'm from the Midwest in the middle of nowhere in a cornfield. And no one can pronounce any ethnic names here.
If you pronounce it that way, nobody knows who you're talking about.
Exactly.
And Kirti, how do I pronounce your name correctly?
It's Kirti. It's a double E, which is a long E.
Mm-hmm.
And Compella.
That's easy.
Yeah. Just don't say Compella, which is a few people say.
Spanish, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's straightforward, except Indians can't pronounce my name.
Why is that?
There's a much more common name, which is Kirti.
Ah, okay.
There's no E in the middle. And it's much more common. So they just assume that's what it is. And I have to keep reminding them. There's a double E in there for a reason. And then the other thing that happens with the Italians is it's Chiretti.
Of course.
Like, what? Where did that come from?
Chiretti Compella.
Mine's simple. I have Chris Young. Yeah,
you got it.
But most people seem to think I'm Chinese. Yeah, I get that
one. You just misspelled it. You need Y-U-N-G or something.
Yep, exactly.
You're missing the Fu. It needs to be Chris Young Fu.
Or Ping or,
or something.
Yeah. Lee.
Well, you could use Ping. We could relate to that.
Right. And then when you grow up, you can be traced out. Never mind.
No, you have the perfect audience for that joke.